Here we go. We're up to Parshat Vayishlach. The entire Parshat Vayishlach takes about 2 years, according to most Mefarshim. I'll show you later that not everyone agrees. According to most Mefarshim, it's 2 years. From the time Yaakov leaves the house of Lavan until his arrival in Hebron to the home of Yitzchak. Now, when Yaakov is entering Eretz Israel, he sends messengers to Esav. Esav right now is not in Israel. Esav is in Edom. Edom is southern Jordan, and he lets him know that he is returning. Now, after the confrontation with Lavan, where he is accused, Yaakov is accused of stealing his heart. He's lama ganafat livi. Why did you steal my heart? When he left in the middle of the night, he realizes that he's basically been scheming his whole life. You think about it, first he schemed by getting Yaakov to give him the right of the firstborn only because Esav says, I want some soup. He goes, oh, you want soup? No problem. Give me the rights of the firstborn. So he schemes him there. Then he gets the blessing. Okay, obviously working together in tandem with his mother, but still he realizes that he basically deceives his father. And then, before he leaves the house of Lavan, he comes up with this whole idea of how to make money with the speckled and spotted sheep, to the point that Lavan comes running after him, and he says, okay, so first he gets all of his cattle, which we'll see how much there is in a second, and then he sneaks out in the middle of the night, and Lavan runs after him and says, why did you steal my heart? And at this point he decides, no more. I'm not going to be that guy. Basically saying, I became Lavan. Everything that we had to say about Lavan, oh, Lavan was a trickster, oh, he switched the girls in the wedding night. Yaakov's looking at himself in the mirror, and he's saying, I have become Lavan, and I'm not doing that anymore. And now he notifies Esav about his return. He doesn't sneak into Eretz Israel. He lets Esav know, I'm coming. If there's going to be a confrontation, there's going to be a confrontation. So be it. But I'm not going to act in this deceitful way anymore. He's told afterwards that late Esav's on his way to meet you, but he's bringing 400 men. Okay, that's quite a big entourage, little welcoming party. And he prepares. He prepares in three ways. Preparation number one, militarily. He's coming with 400 men. That sort of sounds like an army. So he says, okay, we might be doing battle. So the first thing is, I have to prepare for war. He divides the camp in two. According to Rashi, the hope is at least one hopefully will survive. And according to this, it's sort of split in half. But other Mefarshim say that wasn't in two. The in two was, he had all the men in the front. That was camp number one. In the middle, all the cattle, buffer zone. And at the end, his wife and kids. So who should survive? At least the people in the end. Right? So he again, it is preparing for war. But it's not the way we're used to Rashi. Oh, two different camps equal. No. It's like the men in the front, the battle, the warriors, cattle buffer, and hopefully the wives and kids survive, even if there is a war. Preparation number two. He davens to Hashem. Hashem was the one who instructed him to return. And he davens to Hashem for salvation. And preparation number three, he sends gifts to Esav. Now, the commentary by Rabbi Yitzhak Arama, known as the Akedah Yitzhak, points out that even though he was assured by God that all is good, he still doesn't rely on a miracle. Ein som kanal nes. And he prepares, as I said, in all of these fashions. He sends a large amount of goats, sheep, camels, oxen, and donkeys. Totaling, we get the numbers of all of these, totaling altogether 550 animals. Some explain that this is the Meiser in his original nether. If you recall, when he had the dream of Parshat Vayetze with the Sulam going up and down, he says, if I come back, he says, V'chol ha-shetitein li aser esrenu lach. If that's true, 10% was 550 animals. He had a humongous flock of animals. right? I can understand why Love is a little bit upset about all the speckled and spotted cattle he took away. He's talking about over 5,000 cattle that he's taking. That's a pretty big, yeah. That's a big buffer zone between, you know, the warriors and his kids as well. But this is one view, and this would fit in also with when he says, Yesh li hakol, I have everything, and he sees Esav and says, you're a pinei Elohim. So maybe he says, oh, I'm remembering things that I said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so I'm seeing you, I'm thinking about my nether, and I give you my miser. Others say, and this is the view of Rav Soloveitchik, that he gave basically everything that he had. He kept the bare necessities, and he gave basically everything he had. And why would he do that? Because he's basically trying to say to Esav, forgive me for stealing the Birchat Gashmiat. I don't want it, take it. Anything that I took materialistically, I don't want. I'm coming back to Eretz Yisrael for the spiritual. And therefore, anything that I now own materialistically, I am giving it to you. Let's call this even. I feel bad. I'm asking for mechila. And that's what he's doing. He's giving back the Birchat Gashmiat. And that's not 10%. It will be like 95% or 99% of his cattle. And he says, all I want is the Birchas Avraham, which I was given anyway, and that's the legacy of Kaddish, from Yaakov, legacy from Yitzhak in Eretz Yisrael. That's what I'm coming back for. Take the Birchat Gashmias. Now, Yaakov in camp is preparing for battle, and he decides to take his wives and kids to the other side of Nachal Yabok. According to the Rashbam, it was a panic attack. According to the Rashbam, he's like, oh, he's a battle. He goes, I can't do it. And he starts to run away. Okay? We don't really read this. We're used to reading Rashi. According to the Rashbam, he started to run away. And he was the last. He was getting everyone across the river. Now he's the last to get across the river. And he encounters a mysterious man. According to the Rambam, this was all in a dream. According to the Ramban, it wasn't a dream. He ends up with a limp afterwards, to which those who, you know, explain the Rambam say, no, sometimes dreams can do that. So whatever the case is, this is a machlokas. If this was real or if this was in a dream, who is this mysterious man? Whether it is a human being or an angel, it is clearly representing Esav. He's called an Ish, but clearly this is some sort of representative of Esav, the Saroshel, Esav, an angel. He's injured in the thigh, and from this point, we are prohibited from eating the Gir HaNasheh, the part of the meat that's the filet mignon. In Israel, you can get filet mignon. In America, you can't. In Israel, you get the filet mignon because we don't have that much meat, so they take the effort to take out that vein, and you can eat all the meat around it. In Chutz La'aretz, meat is so cheap, they just chop off that whole piece and throw it feed it to the goyim. So, for those who are into having all the different types of tastes of meat, they come to Israel and order it. Okay. He's injured, but victorious. He beats the angel. By morning, the angel is screaming, let me leave, let me leave. And Yaakov says, not until you give me a bracha. As we know, the angel says, no longer shall you be called Yaakov. You will be called Yisrael. It's a little strange that later on God has to say the same thing. If this was an angel, he said it. It's even more strange that he is called later on Yaakov, but we'll come to that later. And this is what he tells him. You are now Yisrael. At birth, he was holding on to the heel of Esav. And he got the name Yaakov. Ekev is heel. You could say he was being stepped on by his brother as he was coming out of the womb. He stepped on him there, and that's Yaakov. And now he fought back, and he won. You're no longer being stepped upon. No, you are victorious. You are Yisrael. Or, Rav Soloveitchik suggested, Yaakov signifies dependence. He's holding on. He has to hold on to something. And Yisrael signifies independence. You don't need to hold on to anything. You're your own man. Okay? The Ramban sees the symbolism in the encounter. The Ramban, as we have mentioned in the past, is always into Ma'aseh Avot Siman LeBanim. And he said, that we will be attacked by anti-Semites throughout our history, and even we will be injured, but we will survive, we will be victorious. I mentioned to Rav Ami at lunch, we're having a discussion, and I remember that we were in Poland once many years ago. I'd say, how old is he now? Let's say 15 years ago. My son was with me. We were in some place. The person was taking us around, was trying to show us where his father hid out, where they did all this stuff. And these guys saw us, and they got all upset. And they took this big boombox, put it in the window, and they started playing music really loud to try to drown him out. And I was so upset. And I said, oh, this is terrible. Look what they're doing. And he said, Abba, listen to this song. They're playing I Will Survive. They're playing our song. Anyway, so that's it. So we were injured, but we survived. Okay. After this, Yaakov is ready to meet Esav. He first brings the shvachot, the handmaidens, the shvachot, and their children. Then he brings Leah and her children. Then he brings Rachel and her child Yosef. And then he bows to Esav. Esav hugs him and kisses him, and they both cry. Esav refused the gifts, but Yaakov insists. Esav then offers, I will travel with you. I will travel with you. And Yaakov refuses. And Esav returns to Har Seir. He returns to Edom. Yes.
So is there a midrash that says that Esav bit his Yaakov's
nose? Yeah. It says over there, there's like dots on the word that says he kissed him. So the midrash says, what are the dots in the Torah trying to teach? Oh, he tried to bite him, his neck, the marble, whatever. Look, the dots on the Torah is definitely trying to tell you there's something more here. Figure it out. Okay? If it's that or not, I don't know. I'm saying the Pashup Shadi kissed him. But yes, the Midrash gives a drasha because of the dots on the word. Yes?
Wasn't Yaakov's reason for not following this said that, oh yeah, I'm too slow, so go on ahead?
Yeah.
Like he turns a different direction.
Right. So what's the idea? Yaakov had two fears. Fear number one was obviously a battle with Esav. Fear number two was an alliance with Esav. He just finished 20 years with Laban, and he saw what it had done to them. That's what we just spoke about. The angel says, I see what, we had that whole famous Rabbi Lichtenstein, you know, idea. We see what, I see what Laban has done to you. He is as worried about an alliance with Esav as he is a war with Esav. So he sort of says, I can't go with you. And he's able to dodge both, you know, both the war and the alliance with Esav. Before entering Eretz Israel, they stay in a town where he built homes for the people and Sukkot for the cattle. And the name of the city is Sukkot. It's very strange. See, Aruch Chaim points out that this is the first time that a person showed so much compassion for cattle, and therefore the city was named Sukkot, which actually fits in beautifully with the holiday of Sukkot, that Kadosh Baruch Hu, even if we had our own huts, had the Anani HaKavod, had compassion for us above and beyond what was necessary, so it fits in with Yaakov doing above and beyond for caring for his livestock. Okay. They now come to Shechem. According to Rashi, they came, it says, Shalem. Who? What is Shalem? Shalem means what? Whole. So Rashi says, Yaakov came Shalem begufo. Even though he was injured, they come into the city of Shechem, and Yaakov is Shalem begufo. But the Targum Unklus says, no, Shalem is the name of a small village near the larger city of Shechem. And during Beit Sheni, we know there was 5 kilometers from Shechem, a city called Shalem, which would be translated to Salem. There are Salems all over the United States, probably in England as well. Okay, witches in Salem. And that's just the name of Shalem is a village. And if this is so, things are a lot more understandable. Okay, even in the big city of Shechem, that's a big city. There were no high-rise apartments. There weren't that many people. So we're dealing with a small village near the bigger city. So it's probably more like a clan that live there. In Arabic, it's called a chamula, sort of an extended family that lives in one area. And now we also understand why everyone was so loyal to Shechem. These were all just like relatives. He was the head of the household. These were all his relatives. It was a small village, not a large city at all. The Ibn Ezra says, and this is the part that I was hedging my bet, the first statement I made, that they probably lived there for several years. And if so, our parsha takes more than 2 years, because otherwise, if it's right the way it sounds like in the psukim, then Shimon and Levi are going to go fight against the whole city, aren't yet bar mitzvah. It's a little bit strange to think that these young kids that don't have to shave yet are going and taking on a whole city, even if they had a bris milah. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra, doesn't say how long they were there. It would make sense that Yaakov lived there for several years. At this point now, Shimon and Levi are elder teens. Dina is also older. She's not a little like six-year-old being kidnapped and having someone fall in love with her. She's also, you know, a teenager. And this is Ibn Ezra's suggestion. The fault, I'm going to say it's a fault, but the problem that I have with Ibn Ezra is, why then the delay before you go to your father? You know, like, I don't even know why it mentions they went to Shechem. Why did they go to Shechem? Why did they not go straight to Hebron? But be that as it may, and now we're extending even longer till we get to see Grandpa Yitzchak. It's a little bit strange, but it does say they stopped in Shechem. Anyway, why they stopped in Shechem, I don't know. So Ibn Ezra says they already stopped. It was probably several years that they were there. What happens? Dina is kidnapped and raped by Shechem, who's either the king or the prince. And this explains why no one came to her aid when she screamed, because what are you going to do? It's like the king that's doing this. So therefore, okay, he did what he did. Shechem decides he wants to marry her. And he has a meeting with the family. As we know, they make him an offer. He makes an offer. He says, look, why don't we intermarry our two clans? We'll do business. We'll intermarry. It'll be good for everybody. Some sort of partnership. The brothers stipulate that that's impossible all the while that you guys are uncircumcised. We can't do that. But if you guys get circumcised, then yeah, we can have businesses. We could have do business deals and we could intermarry. And it's all good. What happens? The entire city agrees. And now, while they are recovering from their circumcision, from their surgery, Shimon and Levi go to rescue Dina, kill all the males, and afterwards, their brothers take the spoils. And Yaakov rebukes Shimon and Levi for their actions. What is the response of Shimon and Levi? Hakzonaya set achotenu. Should our sister just be treated like a whore? We had to do what we did. Now, the question is, didn't Yaakov understand that was their ploy? I mean, wasn't it clear during negotiations that that's what this is all about? Really? Do you really think if they're circumcised, we could intermarry? Goyim in America circumcised. No one said, hey, they're circumcised, we could intermarry. So, like, what was this all about? Wasn't it obvious that this was their plan all along? So the answer that is most often given is there was plan A and plan B. Plan A is they'll probably never go along with it. Shechem will bring it to town hall meeting and say, all right, what do you guys say? And they would say, not a chance. Why would we do that? Because you have the hots of some girl, we should get circumcised? No. That's plan A. And then they won't be able to deliver on their promise not to give Dina back. And if they wouldn't, and if, let's say, they actually get circumcised, well, now everyone's weak, we can do a rescue mission. And we'll rescue Dina. We don't have to kill anyone. And if you have to kill anyone, it'll be Shechem and his father, Hamor. You know, but like, no one else has to be killed.
Do you not kill all the males?
But they did. So this is what Yaakov has said about. Yaakov said, even plan B, if they for some reason should go along with this, so rescue Dina. And if you have to kill anybody, it would be maybe Shechem. But maybe even that he would be upset about. I gave my word. So some say he would be upset about even the murder of Shechem and Hamor. And others say, no, that would be okay. But why all the collateral damage? Why did they kill everyone else? This is what Yaakov would say. Now, what would be Shimon and Levi's response? Yeah?
Well, the whole city did nothing about it.
What?
The whole city did nothing about it.
They did nothing about it, but also, it's like, I don't have to keep my word to a rapist kidnapper. I mean, we're not talking about, oh, here's a potential business partner. Let's like, this guy took our daughter, our sister, hostage, raped her. You know, like, what, honor my word? We don't have to. Now, you could also argue, even take Aaron further, maybe these people came to defend Shechem and Hamor, or would now go defend Shechem and Hamor, and therefore there would be a need to kill them so that we can get away. You can, from a military point of view, you know, explain that as well. But even without that, they're saying, you're worried about keeping your word? This guy kidnapped and raped your daughter. Here's the interesting thing. The Torah seems to side with Shimon and Levi, even though Yaakov keeps his view till his dying day. Even when Yaakov's on his deathbed, he reprimands Shimon and Levi. Right? We talk about the brachot that he gives. He doesn't give brachot to Shimon and Levi. He rebukes them. So till his dying day, he does not change his view on what Shimon and Levi did. He holds a grudge. But the Torah seems to side with Shimon and Levi. And I'll give you some proofs. First of all, they get the last word in. The story ends with them saying, should a sister be treated like a whore? End of story. We move on to the next story. Number two, several times in Perek Lamed Daled, we have a narrator telling us, and what was done, the abduction, this is despicable. Sort of like we're getting like the narrator's view. Narrator for us obviously is God, saying, this is a disgusting thing that happened. Sort of giving us reason to agree with Shimon and Levi's action. And third, Yaakov's argument was, oh, I can't believe you did that. That was such a stupid move. Now all the neighbors are going to come and attack us. And yet the Torah goes out of its way to say that because of what they did, everyone was scared to start up with them. So it turned out to actually strike fear into the neighbors, and no one thought to attack them. It's also possible that Shimon and Levi did this and didn't really care what Yaakov said because they felt, how did Yaakov not go to save his daughter? Is it because she's Dina bat Leah? What if she would have been Dina bat Rachel? Would Yaakov act the same way if his beloved wife's kid was taken? I think it's just because it's Dina bat Leah, because they referred to over and over as Achei Dina. Achei Dina. They are standing up for her honor, and they really expected their dad to do it, and they felt that he wimped out. Possibly, suggesting, but it could be that this is their view of it, and therefore, they even after the rebuke, they're convinced that what they did was the right thing. Solomon.
You said the Torah treats is on their side, but later on, they are no longer treated like the first one. Reuben, the list of tribes, Reuben's not the top because of he might have slept with Bilhah or whatever it was. And then Simeon and Levi aren't mentioned. As I go south to Judah, Simeon and Levi aren't mentioned because of this incident.
So there's two separate things. One is leadership and one is the Bechor. Leadership, Yehuda showed leadership skills, and we're going to get to that. When he goes and he saves Binyamin. Okay? And as far as the firstborn, they're not firstborn. So it goes to Yosef. He's the firstborn of a different mother. Okay? Okay. They move to Beit El. And Yaakov tells his family to get rid of the Avodah Zarah that was taken in the spoils. And they buried under a tree. They then found out that Devorah, the nursemaid of Rivka, died. And they buried her. So, how did they know? How did they know that she died? The Ramban suggests that she had been sent back to live in Padan Aram. And by Rivka, no longer needed. And now, when Yaakov was returning, he returned with her. He's bringing her back, and she passed away. And Hakara Satov, she had taken care of his mother. So they have a whole funeral. But it is very strange. We don't mention the death of Rivka Imenu. We mention the death of Rivka Imenu's nursemaid, Dvorah. That's odd. Like, what's that all about? Says the Ramban a very interesting thing. Really, really interesting. You know why Rivka's death is not mentioned? You start doing the Ramban? Okay. You know why it doesn't mention? Because no one buried her. Yitzhak was blind, and he couldn't bury her. Yaakov was away, he couldn't bury her. And Esav felt that his mother didn't like him because she tried to cheat and get the bracha for his other brother and not for him. So you know who buried Rivka? The neighbors. The neighbors had to bury Rivka. Yitzchak didn't. Yaakov didn't. Esav didn't. Torah didn't want to tell us how embarrassing that is. So therefore, we don't even mention her burial. But Devorah, her burial is mentioned. Rav Soloveitchik said she gets her significance because it was Devorah who was able to raise Rivka in the house of Rishayim to be a tzedekah. That's the significance of Devorah. How did Rivka become such a great person living with Lavan and Betuah? It was her nursemaid that took care of her, Devorah. But this idea of the Ramban, that the neighbors had to do it, I don't know, that's very interesting. God now appears to Yaakov, and he changes his name to Yisrael. Again, like I said, not clear why it was needed after the angel already did it. And he blesses him to have many descendants and inherit Eretz Yisrael. On the way to Beit Lechem, Rachel gives birth and dies during childbirth. You know, like, we live in a time where women hardly die during childbirth. But it's in the Mishnah. We say it about Mehmet Likin every night. This was a normal thing. You know, like, we can give all sorts of reasons why Rachel might have died there in childbirth, but the simplest might be is that this is what sometimes happens. And Rachel dies during childbirth. And as she's dying, she names her child Ben Oni, the son of, like, my mourning. Like, my death is going to cause mourning. And Yaakov cleans up the name and gives a positive spin on it, Benjamin. The map that you would look at would face east. So to your right would be south. He was the only child born in the south. Everyone else was born up north. And he was born in the south. That is what happened. She dies and is buried there. And a monument is erected there. Ad Hayom Hazeh. Whatever. And that is Kever Rachel. That any of you been to Kever Rachel? Okay. So Kever Rachel, Derech Ephrata. Yes, sir.
I have a question. Why it did not lay out for Zilpah or Bilhah dying childbirth and only Rachel?
You can't answer that question. I don't know. I don't know why do some babies die childbirth and others don't. I don't know.
No, because you said it's very common.
I know. It doesn't mean everyone. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a human race. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm sure there are midrashim to give all sorts of reasons. The most common is Rashi's idea that since Yaakov cursed her, whoever stole the truffim should die, so now she's dying because of that. There's another idea of the Ramban that the Avos only kept mitzvot, so the Avos kept mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael. And you're not allowed to marry two sisters. All the while that Yaakov was married to Rachel and Leah in Chutz Laaretz, it was okay. Now, as they entered Eretz Yisrael, the second one to come into the marriage had to die because Yaakov couldn't be married to two sisters. There are different ideas given. Those are midrashim. I'm just saying the pshat could just be that, I don't know, women died during childbirth, but there are ideas that are put forward to try to explain. They move to Migdal Eder, and there Reuven sleeps with Bilhah. Reuven sleeps with Bilhah. He takes his stepmom. The pasuk says he sleeps with Bilhah. And this is because he's upset that his mother is still number two. When his mother was number two to Rachel, playing second fiddle, so then, all right, maybe you can deal with that. This is a full-fledged wife. When Rachel dies, obviously Leah should move in to be numero uno, right? But what does Yaakov do? Yaakov now takes Rachel's handmaiden Bilhah and sort of appoints her to be first wife. And Reuven will have none of that. And therefore, according to the Pashut Pshat, sleeps with her. According to Rashi, this is what we all brought up, he moved her bed. Moved her bed. I just want to point out that you should know there are definitely Mefarshim and opinions in the Gemara that say Reuven actually slept with her. I know we're all brought up on Rashi, but it's not the only view. There, in the Gemara it says that Reuven slept with her, and I'll speak about this more later after Hanukkah when I do my Chumash Shir, what will be the rationale behind that. But this is this idea. According to Rav Soloveitchik, so why is it written, if he just moved the bet, why is it written as if it was Gilei Arayos? So the Rav has a beautiful, beautiful idea. It explains something in a parsha later on. We know that Reuben wanted to save Yosef from being killed. And he says, don't kill him, throw him in the pit. Right? But then what happens? Yosef sold. Correct? So the question obviously is, where was Reuben? Does anyone remember? What does Rashi say?
Say, like, trying to get forgiveness.
Right. Mornings, doing tshuva for forgiveness that he had done what? Okay. Says Rav Soloveitchik, it was only after Reuven so disrespected his father, even disrespect means moving the bed, that the brothers now felt, we could also disrespect dad. And yes, we know that Yosef is his favorite son, and now we're going to come home without his favorite son, but Reuven already paved the path that we don't have to care about Abba's feelings. And that's what he was doing tshuva about. When he heard that the brother was saying, let's kill him, or this, or that, or throw him in the pit, let him die, he realized, that happened because I first disrespected Abba. And that's what, because the question is, now is the time you're doing tshuva? You did that years ago. You picked this one moment to do it? I said, Rosalie, yeah, because now it hit you. Now it hit you that this disrespect that's being shown to Yaakov is only because you're the first one. You paved the path that it's okay to disrespect Abba. I thought that was such an interesting way of looking at it. And then it could be, whether he slept with her, he moved the bed, he disrespected, and the brothers will say, we don't have to care about Abba's feelings. All 12 sons are listed, saying afterwards, seemingly, that they all still part of Klal Yisrael. They finally make it to Hebron. They reunite with Yitzhak, who dies at the age of 180, is buried by both Yaakov and Esav in Marat HaMachpelah. And the last parak just lists the descendants quickly of Esav, including the kings of Edom. We go through it quickly before we now get into all the stories of Bnei Yaakov, which will be the end of the Sefer Bereishis. We'll have left the Avos and moved on to the Banim. Okay, pick it up with that next time.